I next met with Dr. John Haymock, who always brings a fresh and interesting perspective to discussing the translational basis for targeted biologic treatment. And Dr. Haymock began by commenting on research on the use of anti-angiogenic agents in lung and other cancers, and evolving trials like ECOG 1505 evaluating this strategy in the adjuvant setting.
When we initially were designing studies using angiogenesis inhibitors, and I was mentored by Judah Folkman, who was really the pioneer in developing the concept of angiogenesis inhibition, his initial conception is that angiogenesis inhibition might prevent microscopic tumors or dormant tumors from starting to grow, which is really describing perfectly what we're trying to do in the adjuvant setting. You're trying to keep micrometastases dormant or eliminate them. So the early prediction was that angiogenesis inhibitors would work better in the adjuvant setting as opposed to the metastatic setting, where tumors already have well-established vessels and are larger and much tougher to inhibit with an angiogenesis inhibitor. So this really led a lot of people to believe that if angiogenesis inhibitors were really going to have a big impact, it would be a bigger impact in the adjuvant and early stage setting in the metastatic setting. Now, the colorectal study was really a mixed result, and I think it depends on who's interpreting the results. So on one hand, the colorectal adjuvant study did not show harm, and actually it showed a strong trend towards benefit for the duration of time that the patients received therapy. And I believe they received bevacizumab for 1 year.
Right, and they actually had, I think it was a 40% drop during it. And if this study endpoint had been 2.5 year disease-free survival, it would have been positive. But by the time they got to 3 years, it was gone.
That's exactly right. So you could argue that that's consistent with the angiogenic hypothesis, that there was a benefit in terms of preventing microscopic metastases from progressing while you got the drug, but that benefit disappeared once you stopped the drug. So, you know, if you give it for a longer period of time, it certainly seems feasible that there could be a benefit seen in that setting.
Is that what you think?
I believe so. You know, I think we'd like to see a larger benefit, of course, than was actually observed. But I do believe that if it was continued, there likely would be a reduction in disease progression.
I think I remember you're telling me that Dr. Folkman actually felt like it would make more sense to give it long-term or even indefinitely.
Right. That's right. Now, bevacizumab, of course, does have toxicities associated with it. And now having a large enough cohort of patients that have been receiving it for more than a year, you know, I can say things do happen. It wouldn't be the easiest drug to give for multiple years, even the cost issues aside.
Although we also saw in the ovarian plenary talk this year that they didn't see very much when they got short-term Bev with chemo, but they did when they went out to 15 months.
That's right. So, you know, at least my interpretation of the data across multiple different disease settings is that there's really two different types of benefit that's being derived from bevacizumab. One of them is clearly adding to the effectiveness of chemotherapy. So in study after study, we're seeing an increase in the response rates during chemotherapy. So even if you look cycle for cycle, you're increasing the amount of tumor shrinkage that's occurring, and often doubling it or more if you look, for example, at the ECOG 4599 study by Sandler and colleagues. So an impressive increase in tumor shrinkage. There does also appear to be an effect or a potential effect when it's continued over time, but that question has been much less well answered. So for example, in the setting of lung cancer, the original ECOG 4599 study by Sandler and colleagues was done with maintenance bevacizumab, and nobody had ever addressed whether or not there'd be less benefit or more benefit if you stopped the bevacizumab right at the end of chemotherapy. And I think a similar lesson applies in other solid tumors where it's approved as well. Now, there's an added wrinkle to all this that people hadn't anticipated in the beginning with angiogenesis inhibitors. One notion was that if you had ones that were easier to give, for example, oral TKIs, that might be more amenable to long-term dosing. But one of the things that wasn't anticipated is that the angiogenesis inhibitors themselves induce changes in the host. So by that, I mean, when you look at circulating levels of angiogenic factors and cytokines, you actually see changes induced by VEGF receptor inhibitors and by bevacizumab, probably to a lesser extent. So, for example, if you give a drug like sunitinib, we had originally shown in GI stromal tumor, and it's been shown in other malignancies as well, renal cancer. Recently, we've shown it in lung cancer, that you get increases in VEGF, increases in placental growth factor, decreases in soluble VEGF receptor 2, which likely acts as a sponge soaking up extra soluble VEGF circulating around the circulation. And in fact, work from Bob Kerbel's group in mouse models has really elegantly shown that the angiogenic factors and cytokines that are induced by these tyrosine kinase inhibitors are partly dependent on the tumor and partly dependent on the host. So even in people that don't have tumors, it appears they get increases in these angiogenic factors and cytokines just from taking the sunitinib or other tyrosine kinase inhibitor by itself. So this raised the theoretical possibility that it could actually be ramping the tumor up or accelerating it in some ways by increasing all these angiogenic factors. And when you stop the drug, that may have a biologic impact. Now, consistent with this, we recently conducted a colorectal study. This was led by Scott Kopetz and was published in JCO recently, where we looked at patients treated with bevacizumab and chemotherapy with colorectal cancer. And during treatment, right before the tumors progressed, we did see an increase in basic FGF, in HGF, and a host of other cytokines that are involved in recruiting inflammatory cells. So you do see these changes that occur when people are being treated with angiogenesis inhibitors. In that regard, I'll mention one really interesting preclinical study from Bob Krobel's lab. So here they took VEGF receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitors like sunitinib, and they gave them to mice that didn't have tumors, and then they implanted tumors. And they found out that pretreatment with the angiogenesis inhibitors actually accelerated the growth of tumors. Now, this is when they weren't giving it after they implanted the tumors. So really what it was saying is that you can actually ramp up the host, or the host compensates when they're given these drugs, so a person or in those studies a mouse, by increasing the amount of angiogenic factors they're producing, and that can impact the tumor as well. So this is to say we have a lot more to understand about the host response to these drugs and the host response to VEGF inhibitors and possibly to EGFR inhibitors may actually have consequences for tumor growth as well. So this is at least one possible theory to explain how tyrosine kinase inhibitors could increase tumor growth after either consolidation chemotherapy in the SWOG-023 study or potentially in the adjuvant setting in BR19.
I was following you pretty well when you were talking about the VEGF TKIs, but then you kind of jumped over there to EGFR TKIs. What would be the theoretical reason there?
Well, that's a great question. So the changes induced by VEGF receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitors are very well established. And you know, as I said, it's been done by multiple other groups in addition to our group, and it's also been done in preclinical models. The changes induced in the host by EGFR TKIs is not as well characterized. So we've recently looked at this from a large randomized study called the BATTLE that we've conducted, the BATTLE study.
And the biopsies.
Yeah, a biopsy and biomarker-driven study conducted at MD Anderson. And people are starting to look at this with other drugs like cetuximab. And again, Bob Krobel's lab's recently done some work with mouse models. And what we can say at this point is there are changes induced. They appear to be different than the changes induced by VEGF receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitors. But I think more work needs to really be done to understand how these changes are induced, what part of it's due to effects on the tumor and what part's due to the host. But it does highlight the dangers of focusing all of our attention on just the tumor and not paying attention to what happens to the host. And in this regard, as biomarkers are being developed for VEGF inhibitors, it turns out some of the best biomarkers look like they may be germline polymorphisms.
SNPs?
SNPs, in other words, of VEGF and IL-8 and other genes related to angiogenesis. And what this is saying is different people respond differently to the drugs independent of the effects on their tumors, which is something that makes sense. And this may be particularly important for drugs that attack normal cells, so drugs that attack endothelial cells or blood vessels, like angiogenesis inhibitors. There, it really may be more dependent on the host response to drugs as compared to what's happening in the tumor. So, you know, it clearly indicates that we're going to have to broaden the net that we're casting, looking for things to predict who's going to respond. And we have to take into account what happens in the host as well as what's happening in the tumor. And so in some ways, the tumor is going to be the easy part, looking for mutations. Understanding the complex interactions with the host is going to be more challenging.
Every time I sit down and talk to you, John, I know I'm going to go on a ride. I'm not sure where it's going to lead, but as long as we're getting into it. Well, you know, there are very few people who have that broad kind of translational, you know, vision. As long as we're getting into all, you know, all the questions I always have talking to people from different tumor types. You know, another issue is, for example, Bev or anti-angiogenic agents, are they acting very differently in different tumors? Two that stick out in my mind, well, there are several that stick out in my mind, ovarian, renal, GBM, where you see single agent response rates Is that fundamentally different than what we see with colon, lung, and breast, and maybe just completely different in terms of sort of what's going on?
Yeah, well, I think it's an extremely important question that you just raised. And we can make the initial observation that response rates to just angiogenesis inhibitors by themselves are different in the different diseases. You know, so that just tells us to start with that there are differences. Of course, the best single-agent responses to angiogenesis inhibitors have been observed in renal cancer. And the way I think about it, and I think a lot of other people in the field think about it, is renal cell cancer tends to be, at least clear cell renal cancer, it tends to have an angiogenic drive that seems to be coming from predominantly a single pathway, the HIF-1 alpha pathway. So either through sporadic mutations or other mechanisms, usually the HIF-1 alpha pathway is dysregulated in renal cell cancer. That's a major regulator of VEGF. Usually happens through the VHL mutations, von Hippel-Lindau mutations, that cause the dysregulation of HIF. And so the net result of that is the tumors that have dysregulation of the HIF-1 alpha pathway seem to be more dependent on VEGF by itself. We believe other tumors may have a lot more different factors driving angiogenesis, you know, whether it's the NF-kappa-B pathway in some cases, inflammatory pathways in other cases, but there seems to be a wider diversity of angiogenic factors in some of the other malignancies. So renal cancer is certainly the most responsive. You can look at pancreatic cancer, and there is no benefit whatsoever seen for the addition of bevacizumab to chemotherapy. Thinking about lung cancer, bevacizumab by itself has had low response rates when it's been looked at. It hasn't been tested in a randomized phase 3 study, but response rates in phase 1 setting have been very low. And tyrosine kinase inhibitors have had a little higher response rates. If you look at sunitinib or vendetinib, which have mixed effects, not only targeting VEGF but other things, you know, they're in the single digits, you know, in the range of 7 to 10% in terms of their response rates. So tumors do respond differently. Renal cell is the most responsive to angiogenesis inhibitors by itself. Some tumors haven't had any benefit, and we don't understand exactly why. We don't have the tools to predict exactly which ones are going to respond or not respond, but it seems to be that tumors can develop bypass pathways to VEGF. And I mentioned before the colorectal study where we followed patients treated with chemotherapy and bevacizumab. And there we saw a rise in all these other angiogenic factors after patients had been on for a long time, and that was the harbinger of disease progression. So once we saw rises in basic FGF and HGF and placental growth factor and several of these other angiogenic factors, the next cycle we usually saw disease progression. So tumors, as they always have, find out a way to overcome our best efforts to block them, and we need to understand better how to predict who's going to benefit.
You mentioned the BATTLE study, and actually I interviewed Roy Herbst for the same program that you're going to be on. And so he kind of went through the clinical aspects of it in terms of how they did it, which agents they used. But what was your take on some of the specific tissue factors they looked at and what they saw? You know, they had some people got vandetanib, some got gefitinib. Was it gefitinib or erlotinib?
Erlotinib.
Some got erlotinib. Some got it was
sorafenib.
Sorafenib.
And then erlotinib and bixarotene.
Right. So how did you? Is there any? Could you put together what was seen in terms of the tissue factors at all?
Well, yeah, it's a great question, and I'll just briefly review what the BATTLE study was. So this is one we've conducted at MD Anderson with over 300 patients enrolled. And it was unique because it was platinum refractory patients, and every single patient got a new biopsy. And just as a side note, this was something that people said was not feasible when we started, that it would be dangerous for patients. Patients would never be willing to do it. And one of the lessons we learned from this, that it was really the oncologist's resistance that was the biggest obstacle. And patients were more than willing to do this, understanding that this would contribute to potentially in the future better lung cancer treatments, even if it didn't directly benefit them. And after more than 200 biopsies, we had one overnight hospitalization, which wasn't a particularly serious one. So it showed that it was not dangerous to patients and it was feasible. Now, the four arms of this study were erlotinib, erlotinib plus bixarotene, which is a retinoid, an RXR inhibitor, sorafenib, and vendetinib. So it's a mixture of agents that we believed were either standards or may become standards back when we started the study in 2005 or so, as I was getting it started. The clinical PI of the study was Ed Kim, and Roy Herbst was another one of the PIs. I've led a lot of the biomarker analyses from this study. Now, a couple of the interesting results from it, and I'll point out that we're still in the middle of analyzing all the data from this. We've just unblinded all the results and just done the initial analysis. The first finding was that sorafenib appeared to have very intriguing activity in patients with KRAS mutations. We typically think of KRAS mutations as a marker of resistance to EGFR inhibitors and potentially other therapies.
Everything from what I've seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. But patients with KRAS mutations actually did quite well in terms of their disease control on sorafenib. So this has prompted now subsequent studies that are currently being designed to see if this really may be an effective therapy or more effective than our current standards for patients with KRAS mutations.
What fraction of non-small cell is KRAS positive?
It's on the order of 20%. And KRAS mutations are associated with EGFR TKI resistance, but they're also associated with chemotherapy resistance to some extent. Now, that's controversial, but in the INTEREST study led by Ed Kim, when they looked at KRAS mutations, patients did equally well or poorly, depending on your perspective, whether they got docetaxel or gefitinib in that case.
Any theories about why patients with KRAS-positive tumors would do okay or better on sorafenib?
It's a great question. So the reason we believe that they're resistant to EGFR TKIs is, of course, you've got activation of KRAS, which is one of the important pathways downstream of EGFR. But that activation of the KRAS pathway is not dependent on EGFR. It's essentially bypassing EGFR, and you've just got constitutive activation of that pathway. Now, downstream from RAS, you have RAF and then the MEK and ERK downstream. And sorafenib was initially designed and tested as a BRAF inhibitor, and it does have some BRAF activity, although it's controversial as to whether it's really inhibiting RAF at concentrations that we're achieving clinically. So you can imagine if you've got the RAS pathway active, inhibiting downstream of RAS at the level of RAF or potentially MEK might be an effective strategy. And so that's at least one possible explanation.
As long as you're bringing that up, because it's always a great chance for me to get a little tutorial, what's the difference between BRAF and the BRAF V600 that the melanoma looked at?
Yeah.
It was looked at in melanoma.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. There are different RAS mutations and different RAF mutations depending on the particular malignancy. So in the case of melanoma, which is where we really have seen the greatest effects of the RAF inhibitors, like the Plexxikon drug, for example, the vast majority of cases are V600E RAF mutations.
So it's the same RAF, it's just a specific type of mutation?
That's right. So it's just referring there to the specific amino acid substitution at the 600 position there. We occasionally see RAF mutations in lung cancer. It's on the order of 1 or 2%. They're usually not V600E mutations. Occasionally they are, but they're more often other types of mutations. Similarly, for KRAS mutations, you see different particular mutations depending on what the disease is.
So like the KRAS in colon cancer is not necessarily the same as in lung cancer?
That's right. So often you have different RAS mutations, and they may behave a bit differently. So in lung cancer, smokers versus non-smokers have different RAS mutations. And one is called the transversion, another one's called the transition mutation, having to do with the specific alteration that happens. And it's often at the G12 location. So the glycine at the 12th position is one of the common places that you get alterations. So we need to understand not only what pathways are mutated, but what the impact of the specific mutation is, because some mutations may be activating, some may be associated with resistance. And it makes our studies even more complicated because you can't just say put on RAF-mutated or RAS-mutated patients. You have to really specify and investigate the function of this. And this, of course, comes out in treating lung cancer, where we understand that for EGFR, exon 19 deletions and L858R mutations, which are the most common sensitizing mutations, are highly likely to be sensitive to EGFR TKIs. They actually behave a little differently, so exon 19s have a better prognosis than L858Rs. And then we have a host of other mutations that occur at a lower frequency. And, you know, we have to investigate each of those to find out which ones are sensitizing, which ones are associated with resistance, like T790M and a couple of other resistance mutations. So it just adds a layer of complexity to trying to personalize therapy. And we have to be careful about not jumping ahead of ourselves because each mutation can behave differently.
Any other clues in the battle study? What about vandetanib? And I know you've actually looked at trials of vandetanib.
Yeah.
Looking at markers.
So what was interesting on the vindetinib arm, and I'll mention the bexarotene arm as well, there are some interesting findings. So patients with high VEGF receptor 2 and VEGF actually appeared to do relatively better on vindetinib than those who didn't have those markers being positive.
And I guess we should say vindetinib is a TKI that hits both VEGF and EGFR.
That's right. So it's a dual inhibitor of both VEGF receptor and EGFR, whereas erlotinib is primarily just EGFR. And sorafenib has a much broader profile in terms of having some VEGF receptor activity, some BRAF activity, and hitting other targets as well.
RET.
That's right. And actually, vindetinib also inhibits RET as well. So interestingly, the promising results seen in thyroid cancer from vindetinib are likely to be primarily due to the effect on RET and not VEGF receptor or EGF receptor.
Although I think I heard, I just interviewed Marcia Bros about that, and I thought she said it was maybe VEGF.
Well, we know that the activity is certainly high in types of thyroid cancer that have RET activation. But we also can't rule out the possibility that VEGF is contributing or in some cases may be the main driver. Sorafenib also has activity in well-differentiated thyroids, and Amgen drug AMG-706 does as well. So it's likely multiple targets are being hit, but RET certainly seems to be a feasible target for thyroid cancer. So back to the battle study, again, we saw that high levels of VEGF receptor 2 on the tumor seemed to portend a relatively better response to vindetinib, whereas the VEGF receptor 2 didn't have that impact for erlotinib. And then lastly, for the RXR inhibitor, the retinoid bexarotene, and this is a drug that's approved for cutaneous T-cell lymphomas, there has been a number of studies out there suggesting that high levels of cyclin D or cyclin D amplification may be a marker of response. And our preliminary analysis suggests that may actually be the case for the combination of erlotinib with bexarotene. And overall, that combination actually looked very good. Now, the numbers are modest, and it's hard for us to compare results between the arms because of the statistical design that I'll talk about in a moment. But what this study does is it, first of all, demonstrates the feasibility of doing a biomarker-driven, biopsy-requiring study in platinum-refractory lung cancer patients. And it also gives us some very interesting leads for identifying patients that might respond to one of these drugs or the other. That gives us a very firm foundation now for subsequent definitive studies. Now, I'll just mention a word about the design and what made this unusual. This is one of the first studies of this size and scope that incorporated tumor markers using what we call a Bayesian adaptive randomization design. And what that means is the following. It means you're incorporating information from the study as you go along. So typically you set up a study design and you might say, everybody with this marker gets treatment A and somebody with a different marker gets treatment B. And when you start the study, it's set and it runs its course unless the study is amended. The way this study worked is it would take information if you had a certain marker profile and you had a great response to drug number one, then the subsequent randomization favored that marker towards drug number one. It strengthened that probability. Now, it didn't guarantee you were going to get that. If you had that marker, it didn't guarantee you were going to get drug number one, but it increased the probability. So over time, you hope that the drugs become more and more closely associated with the markers that they're more likely to have a response to in real time. So you're learning as you go along.
It makes a lot of sense. You know, when you think about it, I mean, you all managed to get more than 300 patients. This was really amazing. On the other hand, you can envision if you had enough resources, you could get like 30,000 patients in a year. I mean, there's so many people who could go into a study like that.
Yeah. I think that's right. And we really regard this as proof of concept. I mean, besides the information we've learned here, it's the type of study we hope will be done more in the future and not the particular drugs or the particular markers, but the approach of going through the effort of collecting these biomarkers, because everybody recognizes the need now for tailoring our therapies based on the characteristics of the tumor and likely the patient as well. But it's hard work developing those markers. And what it requires is obtaining the markers, treating the patient in a well-controlled study where you can measure the outcome and compiling that information. And that's really where we're falling short in the area of lung cancer. If you look at the percentage of lung cancer patients who go on clinical studies, it's among the lowest in any malignancy. And arguably, it's a case where we need these studies the most. So again, hopefully that principle of embedding biomarkers into the studies to help us identify leads much more quickly will be followed more broadly. And there are certainly a lot of other good efforts in that regard underway by other groups as well.
Anything else you want to say about the battle study or biomarkers?
Well, one of the things I'd like to point out is the study had a set of what we called primary markers that are actually embedded in the study, and the patients were randomized based on these primary markers. And these included some obvious things, EGFR mutation, KRAS mutation, EGFR amplification. But then it included a rich host of what we call discovery markers. So these are markers that are not established, but we're really just looking and hunting for new ones. So for example, we obtained gene expression data using a genome-wide arrays from Affymetrix from the majority of patients in the study. And this has enabled us to develop gene expression signatures predicting response to erlotinib and other drugs in the study. So this gives us something in our hand now that we can test in the subsequent studies to see if these gene expression signatures hold up. And we believe this is an approach that's already being applied in other diseases like breast cancer, of course. And we believe it's fertile territory in the area of lung cancer. One other thing we did was a lot of blood-based biomarkers, so assessing different cytokines and angiogenic factors and other plasma markers. And we believe there's important predictive information in the blood as well. And you also can detect mutations through the blood. So this sort of study helps establish a framework for hopefully using blood-based biomarkers instead of new biopsies over time. And that'll take a while to develop all the technologies. But I believe one day we'll be doing much of our monitoring, if not all of it, using blood instead of tumor.
You mentioned resistance to EGFR TKIs. What are your thoughts about the so-called irreversible EGFR TKIs? BIBW2992 is one that was presented at ASCO. Yeah. What do we know about these agents and this agent specifically?
Yeah, well, I think irreversible EGFR inhibitors are potentially a very important development in the field. The reason they're important is the following. We know that EGFR TKIs like gefitinib and erlotinib bind reversibly to the pocket in the EGF receptor tyrosine kinase, where they have their effect. The way the drugs work is normally a kinase binds ATP, and it takes a phosphate off ATP and it uses to activate or phosphorylate other proteins. And drugs like gefitinib and erlotinib mimic ATP, and they fit in that ATP pocket. But when the EGFR kinase is mutated, it actually has an increased affinity for gefitinib and erlotinib. It becomes more sensitive to it and a lower affinity for ATP. Over time, however, it develops a second mutation, and a classic one is T790M mutation, so a threonine substituted for methionine at the 790 position. And when that happens, gefitinib and erlotinib are no longer effective. The tumor becomes resistant to both of those because essentially the mutation causes structural alterations that make those drugs bind less well and makes ATP bind much better. What the irreversible inhibitors do is they bind the pocket in a different way than gefitinib and erlotinib do. And once they bind, they actually irreversibly bind. They have a covalent linkage and they stay stuck to the receptor. So despite the presence of a T790M, they should be able to inhibit the EGFR protein. So we believe this may delay or prevent resistance that emerges through the T790M mechanism. They also inhibit wild-type EGFR well, if you're talking about drugs like BIBW2992. So there's a couple of large randomized studies with BIBW2992 that we're eagerly awaiting the results of. And the phase 2 data for that drug looks impressive. You know, it really does give us hope that it may provide another alternative to just using reversible EGFR inhibitors. I suspect it's going to become a valuable tool in the fight that we'll eventually use in addition to reversible inhibitors.
Another translational story that I heard recently that, even though I've heard an awful lot about nab-paclitaxel in our breast cancer programs, I met with Mark Sosinski, and he was talking about, you know, he kind of talked about SPARC, but he used the phrase that really stuck in my mind that tumors are albumin sponges. Any thoughts about that whole scenario?
Well, we know that tumors have different vasculature, for one thing, and have some other properties that make them different than normal tissues. So normal tissues have well-established blood vessels that developed in a normal way. And so a normal blood vessel has a layer of covering around it. It has a basement membrane. It has surrounding cells like smooth muscle cells and pericytes. And all these contribute to the structural integrity of a vessel. So it becomes tight. It works efficiently. Tumors don't have anything like that. They have very tortuous, leaky, inefficient blood vessels. that just grow in all different directions. So what that means is that tumors, things leak through. They can have a lot of edema. They have what we call high interstitial pressure because of all the leaking of fluid into the tumor. So they're very compressed. And it means you can at least demonstrate theoretically that things that would normally stay inside of a blood vessel like albumin have a tendency to leak out around the tumor. Now, this is an effect we would love to take advantage of, and this happens with other polymers. So, for example, when you look at polymer-conjugated drugs, like polymer-conjugated platinum analogs and so forth, at least theoretically, it should provide a way that they leak out around tumors but don't leak out of normal vessels. And if that happens, you should be able to achieve a higher concentration in the tumor than you can achieve elsewhere in the body. So really what that potentially could do is improve the therapeutic index, get more in the tumor, less in normal tissues. Now, whether that's translated to clinically meaningful differences yet is hard to say. I can't say that these drugs developed on this concept have had a major impact yet, but theoretically it's a sound concept and there is some intriguing data so far in terms of effectiveness and tolerability of some of these conjugates.